Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with the editor of Park City Magazine, Jane Gendron. We'll be talking about some of the highlights in this year's summer issue on newsstands now, as well as some of the challenges putting it together during a pandemic. South Summit School District Superintendent Chad Sorensen and Business Administrator Adam Robinson will be on the phone talking about the most recent budget hearing, setting next year's school budget, with an update on schools opening next month. Finally, Executive Director of the Christian Center of Park City, Rob Harder, talking about some of the services his organization continuing to offer. Stay tuned. 8:10 now, good morning. Well, summertime means road work, and Park City Public Works has paving projects lined up beginning this week. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has details.
Beginning July 6th, the parking lot at the Mark will be shut down while repaving occurs. Public Works Manager Troy Daly says it should take a couple of days to do the work, and he encourages visitors to avoid driving to the center.
On Monday, we are actually doing the parking lot down at the Mark, which will impact the residents who are using the Mark. We're asking them to walk, bike, or take the bus to the Mark for a couple days, which would be Monday and Tuesday.
They'll start milling Woodside Avenue on Tuesday and make their way to the Sweet Alley area on Wednesday.
And then Wednesday, we're going to move right to Sweet Alley with the roto mill and hit Sweet Alley from end to end. And then we're going to pick up the chunk of 4th and 5th Street between Main and Sweet Alley as well. And right behind the mill, once we get it milled one day, the very next day we're trying to come back through and repave it. So we're trying to get in and out as quickly as we can. There will be, you know, after we're all finished, we've still got some striping to do of parking lots, stuff like that, and then readjust water valves and utility accesses.
Daly says they'll start with removing the top layer of asphalt, which shouldn't cause too many traffic delays. The milling and paving will be more impactful.
When we get to where we're milling and paving, it's going to be more impactful and create some delays. For the most part, we don't anticipate any lane closures or road closures. Some streets, the narrow streets, it's almost impossible not to facilitate both traffic or two-way traffic and the work that goes on. And for example, Woodside would be that one of those streets.
In addition, they'll slurry seal roads in some of the in-town neighborhoods during July. They try to finish that yearly project by the 1st of August.
Try to do a pavement treatment within 7 to 10 years on every street we have. It doesn't always mean that we will hit it, but that's the goal. A lot of it depends on the road classification and how the road's being used, whether it's getting a lot of heavy truck traffic and equipment traffic versus a cul-de-sac may not get the same amount of pavement treatments. But we do an inspection each year to assess each street, and then we also have a computer software program that helps us determine what streets and the timing of each street for pavement treatment.
Daly asks residents and visitors to be patient with them. They have a phone line, 435-615-5347, which will be staffed 24/7 to coordinate with people and minimize impacts. A link to the pavement management map can be found on kpcw.org. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
The Park City Council canceled all city-sponsored 4th of July events due to COVID-19 concerns. The council may also raise the safety requirements for other private events to come to town. One of those events, the Triple Crown Softball Tournament, isn't happy about it. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
Scheduled for July 13th through the 18th, the annual Triple Crown Softball Tournament usually brings around 7,000 people to Park City throughout the course of the tournament. The group's Facebook page has a post dated June 30th announcing tournaments in Reno, Nevada, San Diego, California, and Park City have all been canceled. A pop-up message on the Park City event page on the Triple Crown website also indicates the event has been canceled. However, Triple Crown Sports CEO Kerry King says the event is still on.
The suggestion from City Council was loud and clear to not have events this summer in Park City. And so we've actually put our event back in the hopper now, and we're going to be faced with new mitigation efforts that I don't even know what they're going to be.
Park City Economic Development Manager Jonathan Weidenhammer confirmed to KPCW on Thursday if Triple Crown is unwilling to withdraw their event, City Council will consider approval with, quote, heavy conditions on July 9th. Those conditions have not been finalized, but Weidenhammer tells KPCW that measures like a 14-day quarantine for visiting teams, mandatory COVID-19 testing, sterilizing facilities between games, and limiting spectator size are all being considered. Weidenhammer says the council was in a position to put on special events just a few weeks ago, but an increase in COVID-19 cases in Summit County has forced them to reconsider.
The city council was abundantly clear that they didn't want to bring people together. They didn't believe that we could mitigate for the impacts on health, safety, and welfare of the community by facilitating bringing additional bodies here. Triple Crown, I think, would love to hold that event. And I think even 2 or 3 weeks ago, we might have thought we could hold that event, but the data's changed. You know, the reopening of the economy has had, you know, dire impacts, and council is incredibly sensitive to taking a role in doing so. Now, where they didn't cancel, they didn't blanket cancel our summer event calendar, they have set, in my mind, what is an incredibly high bar to mitigate for any events.
King says there will be baseball teams playing in Orem from July 7th to the 11th in a Triple Crown event and will be staying in Park City. He expressed frustration in the council's decision to not prioritize the economic impact of not hosting the tournament.
And yet the city council took the advice of all the emails they got, the influx of grocery store visits that shot up in duration, and the concerns citizens that, in my opinion, are probably second homeowner retirees. They're not in the job force, otherwise they wouldn't have shot themselves in the head.
Park City's city council meeting on July 9th starts at 2 p.m. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Newstime 816. The new edition of Park City Magazine is out on newsstands. On the phone with some of the highlights, I have editor Jane Gendron. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. So first, let's just talk about how difficult it was to put out this issue in the midst of a pandemic.
Well, you know, like everyone, we had to pivot a bit and change our game plan as we went along. I think everyone's still doing that a little bit. But, you know, we shifted gears, and writers and photographers all stepped up, and our team all worked together, and we just had to kind of focus on the outdoors a lot, which is easy to do in Park City. But yeah, at the time, you know, we assigned these stories back in January, and, you know, had the drafts in early March. So we did have to postpone a few. But we were lucky in that a lot of our big features were focused on the outdoors and things that you can do and experience. And so it worked out in the end. But, yeah, we did have to postpone just a few. And you know, it became a bit of a changing magazine from what it originally was.
Sure. Did any stories get redone?
You know, we did. We didn't have to entirely redo stories. I know, for instance, sweet Larry Warren kind of re-interviewed Max Doilney, because we had profiled Max and Jim as one of our summit stories, you know, where we focus on locals and kind of local color. And it seemed, you know, Larry had interviewed Max and Jim before coronavirus hit fully, and so we really thought, since Max was talking about the issues facing the town, and there was a lot of focus on traffic and that sort of thing, that we really should have him talk a little bit about, you know, coronavirus and how that was really a huge challenge for him as a new council member. So yeah, both, you know, interview subjects and writers, everyone had to kind of relook at everything. And obviously on the edit side, we had to make sure we weren't highlighting things that you couldn't do and experience. And so there was shifting and there was tweaking, but total redos, thankfully, didn't have to do.
Yeah. And so the ones that were postponed, was it just due that you couldn't do the interviews, or you couldn't take the photographs, or
no,
it was just because they were closed? They weren't relevant. Yeah.
No, what happened was, so for instance, at the time, you know, pretty much every restaurant was closed. Some were doing curbside. So we had, you know, like a new restaurant feature, or the best place to get a smoothie, where to take yoga classes. And we weren't sure if any of those things would be possible. So we kind of pumped the brakes a little bit. And what we'll end up doing is not abandoning that content, but we'll kind of tweak it, make sure it's still accurate, you know, have maybe a little more reference to new protocols in place, and we'll get it up on our website, parkcitymag.com, first, and then, you know, have it in print either tweaked again at a later date in winter or next summer. Digital is pretty malleable, and we're lucky that we have that outlet as an option to get relevant content up there in a timely manner, even though we love the print and the layout and all of that. But as far as content goes, as far as photography goes, we did end up having to shift a little bit on art design. A lot of our photographers, we just couldn't send them out. We didn't think it would be safe. It was, we didn't know what to do in that case. So we did pause some photography. We were able to get some last minute photography, particularly with profile subjects, which was great. There's actually one photograph in there of Matt Harris and Maggie Alvarez. We did a profile of them and how they're kind of have this budding culinary empire. And we did it through the glass of their restaurant, with them inside to kind of indicate a little bit of social distancing at the time. And then Linda Perkins' son ended up photographing her because we just at the time didn't feel like we could safely, be doing profile shots. And then we had illustrations come into play. Our own art director kind of got out her watercolor set and did some illustrations for Larry Warren's local lore piece on the Glenwood Cemetery. We just kind of shifted and pivoted. Nothing that everyone else isn't doing right now.
Yeah,
all came together.
What about advertising? Did you take a hit there?
We did. Janet, our publisher, and Greg, our sales guy, they just really had to work really hard. We had some advertisers stick with us, but many advertisers stick with us. But with people, having uncertain. A lot of uncertainty. Not everyone could advertise as they would have in the past. So you'll notice, we did go down a few pages as far as content. But in the end result, I was really happy that we were able to pull it all off, and the community, came through and we were able to make it happen.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the features that you've got. You said a lot of it is focused on the outdoors, so that was good.
It sure is. Yeah, thankfully we back last summer, because we had to shoot some of this stuff, we thought, hey, we haven't done a golf feature. Let's look at all of these incredible places to play, and it's something we could do. So Lisa Antonucci, she is kind of the golf guru, and she put together a great piece of kind of different aspects of golf and even non-golf, disc golf, mini golf, with a focus on publicly accessed golf, but also, a piece on the private clubs and a couple of pros, Nate Roberts and John DeBoer, and just an overall big feature on all the spectacular places you can play and what makes them kind of a right fit for whatever kind of golfer you are. And then Melissa Fields did a great piece on local reservoirs. Four of them. So Jordanelle, Deer Creek, Echo, Rockport, kind of the ins and outs, just an insider's guide. And thankfully, I was calling all these places right before we went to print and said, hey, are you open? Are you doing stuff? And everyone, I think there were maybe a couple big events that we had originally mentioned that we took out. Jordanelle has a huge fire on the water thing, and they weren't planning on doing that this year. And maybe the Aqua X Zone, the Wibbit thing, they kind of are postponing or not doing this summer. So we did a little bit of tweaking there, but a lot of the wonderful things you can do at the reservoirs, people can still enjoy. And we had some hiking pieces, one pairing hikes with beers, local beers, kind of a one hike, two hike, one beer, two beer, three beer sort of piece. I'm trying to think what other. We even did kind of a wilderness cocktail hour, locally sourced eats, special cheeses and charcuterie type of eats you could have at the trail or campsite with a pre-batched cocktail that Darby Doyle kind of came up with, a fun little get out there, get outside, but still support local businesses and have a fun time piece. Trying to think what else as far as outdoors. And we have kind of what to do when you encounter different wildlife on the trail to keep them safe and you safe. And I think that's a lot of the outdoor content. Our other big feature was on climate change and kind of how Park City, Summit County, Mountain Town 2030 or MT 2030, the resorts, the nonprofits, the community at large, how everyone is really striving toward these big sustainability goals. So that's kind of a deep dive into sustainability. I know you guys have covered a ton of sustainability, particularly Carolyn, in the past. So just highlighting, obviously, what was and continues to be a huge issue in town, not to be overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic, but all the things that locally, the goals and the plans for how we're going to kind of, get things done before this intergovernmental panel on climate change's 2030 deadline. So that was a big piece that obviously is still timely.
Okay. And then you also got some local color stories. Tell us about those.
Yeah. Well, as you know, lots of great local personalities in town. Our summit stories, as I mentioned, we had Larry do a piece on Jim and Max Doelny, one a former city councilman and one the newest kind of father-son following in their footsteps. Really interesting piece there. Piece on Linda Perkins, who's been a preschool teacher in town for 20 years. And also, let's see, who else? We did a Q&A with Keegan Swenson, really, really phenomenal mountain biker in town, who's an Olympic hopeful for sure. We were hoping it would be all about him going to Tokyo. But, you know, we got to talk about all his favorite trails and how coronavirus has affected his training and that sort of thing. And then J.W. Whiteley, who's a character in town, I think. So Summit Stories got kind of old school, not necessarily by design. It was just kind of the way it worked out. And then there's some fresher faces as well. And who else? I'm thinking Junior Sanchez, Enrique Sanchez. I chatted with him for a piece on DACA because, as you know, the Supreme Court just had a huge decision on the Dreamers and, you know, the people that are a fabric of our community. It was really kind of cool to chat with such an impressive guy who's really, you know, these kids are in a tough spot. So that was a kind of different aspect of our community than the folks that have been here since the 70s and 80s. Who else did we have in here? A little piece on the PC Bladies, who are a really fun group of ladies that get dressed up and have, you know, these meetups where they go and rollerblade and just hang out and open to all. We had Kristen Case did a piece on Terry Orr sort of passing the baton at Park City Institute after her 25 years at the helm there. So, yeah, lots of, and as I mentioned, Matt Harris and Maggie Alvarez, you know, chef, restaurant owner duo. Ted Scheffler did a really great job interviewing them. So, yeah, lots of local folks.
Okay. Where can people get a copy?
Well, they are all out and about in town. The visitor centers are a good bet. I know Dolly's has them. I would say lots of coffee shops. I guess it just depends on if they're doing curbside or not. but I know that our distribution crew sort of tried to hit as many of the usual haunts as they could. And you can obviously, you know, get them on the newsstand at the market or Whole Foods or Fresh Market. You know, you can purchase one, but you can also find them around town in various spots. And yeah.
Okay. All right, Jane, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, you know, it's been really great how people have kind of come together. And I know we've done at the time, it wasn't easy to really do big pieces on all the folks stepping up to the front lines and doing doing really great work, like the folks at the Park City Community Foundation. You know, we give them a little shout out here and there in the magazine, but I think we're able to do some of that online. So certainly a lot of content will be available on parkcitymag.com as things shift and change. But yeah, we're just really, really thankful for the team and the freelancers and the photographers and writers and the team here and at Park City Mag that just were able to kind of shift and make it happen. And of course, our advertisers. We appreciate how it all came together.
Okay.
And thank you for having me on.
All right, Jane, thanks for your time this morning. It's Jane Gendron, the editor of Park City Magazine. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, Sundance Institute announced that they are cutting 24 positions in Los Angeles, New York, and Park City. Some staff will move to reduced schedules with greatly reduced seasonal staff budgets. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more about that.
The Sundance Institute COO and Executive Director Carrie Putnam provides details of the decision to cut approximately 13% of their staff in response to the financial impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Sundance Institute is undergoing a reimagining that will put the 2021 edition of the Sundance Festival in a radically different direction than the traditional event where thousands of people gather in Park City in late January. Putnam says the immediate impact of the virus didn't affect them as much as many nonprofits due to the timing of the film festival, which ended before concerns about the virus spread hit much of the U.S. However, due to the projected shortfalls in contributions and ticket sales, they've cut executive salaries and department budgets across the board, and they've moved all their in-person events to virtual platforms. They anticipate deep economic impacts for the foreseeable future while holding to their mission of supporting independent artists, which they say includes maintaining diversity, equity, and inclusion. Details of the restructuring efforts can be found in the full letter, which is posted on kpcw.org. Putnam's letter outlines the severance packages they will provide for those who are laid off, continued cuts in higher compensated job levels, and changes to benefits packages are expected as well. As KPCW reported Tuesday, Sundance Film Festival Executive Director Tabitha Jackson revealed that the organization is in the process of defining the 2021 event, with a goal of creating a festival that can be accessed locally, globally, in person, and online. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
8:34. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, back on June 25th, the South Summit Board of Education adopted a budget for next school year that starts next month. On the phone, I have the Superintendent of Schools, Shad Sorensen, along with Business Administrator Adam Robinson. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Let's see. Adam, can we start with you and just talk a little bit about what next year's budget looks like?
Yeah, so this year we adopted a budget that really, you know, the state legislature this year was expected to cut anywhere from 2 to 10%. Well, you know, when they met in such special session, that didn't happen, and we were only cut about $67,000. And so that was good news for our schools, and with our current budget, we're able to fund a teacher raise that we're expected to finalize this week with our teachers union. But things went well, and all in all, a great budget. It's a budget of over $32 million, and it funds what we need to do for this next year.
Yeah, what did you budget for student enrollment growth for the coming year?
About 1,720.
I mean, compared to what was the current school year?
It's about a 2.5% increase in enrollment this next year.
Okay, so I guess that's good news because growth was something that the state agreed to fund?
Yes. Yep, that they did fund the growth, and they didn't cut as bad as we thought they were going to, so all in all, a good year.
So where did that $67,000 cut come from? I mean, what was cut?
Most of our cuts came out of our administrative funding, and so the state cut that whole budget, but they made it up in some of the other funds, mainly necessary existing small schools, which we have a couple of schools that qualify for that, and so we made up some of that difference there. So that was the biggest cut, was our administrative costs.
All right. And as you mentioned, you're scheduled to approve a raise with your teachers. Does that hold true for your classified staff and administrators as well?
Well, at this point, we haven't finished negotiations, so that's to be seen.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to tell us about next year's budget?
No. We're just happy that the legislature didn't cut us as bad as we thought they were going to, and we're excited to get back to school and to educate our young people. So,
okay, well, great.
Leslie, if I may jump in, one of the things that Adam was able to build into our budget is we did fund steps and lanes, regardless of any type of a COLA. So all of our staff will receive an increase, kind of a longevity increase. Even if our salary schedule doesn't change, there will be a change there for most everyone. Is that correct, Adam?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, but that step and lane only, it doesn't happen every year, right? I mean, it happens often, but not every year. So some may be at the top of their lane and wouldn't receive that.
We've actually adjusted our schedule so that it allows up to 34 years.
Ah, okay.
For our faculty.
Okay. Well, Chad, let's just talk a little bit about the reopening of schools. When is school supposed to open?
Well, school is supposed to open on the day that we scheduled it, and that is in August. I don't have my calendar right in front of me, but it's the latter part of August, and we anticipate opening school as projected. Now, exactly what that will look like, it could be slightly different from a traditional school year. The state has asked us for districts to release our plan on August 1st, or by August 1st. We have a draft plan that right now we have a committee that has worked on drafting it, and it's being reviewed. We're hopeful that the Board of Education approves it before August 1st so that gives our faculty time to implement that plan if that's the direction they decide to go.
All right. Can you talk to us about some of the components, though, of that draft plan? Are we talking, you know, every other day in the classroom? What are some of the changes that we should expect to see?
Sure. We are trying to draft a plan that would allow us to have every student in school, if possible. And that is our desire. And the plan is flexible and fluid enough that if we can only have half the students on an every other day schedule, it will accommodate that. And if we get to the extreme of not being able to have students in class at all, it will accommodate that. So we've tried to develop a plan that works across the continuum from one end to the other. Our desired goal is to get people, all students, in class every day. As it stands today, the plan starts out a little bit more conservative with starting school on an A-B schedule and then monitoring. And like I say, we believe that we're building a plan that would allow us to be flexible enough that if we, on a Monday, were on an A-B schedule and on a Tuesday decided to allow every student to be able to be in class, that we could do that with that much notice. And the same for the calendar, that if we had every student in class and had to reduce those numbers, that we could do it without missing a beat.
Yeah, so what does that mean for kids? I mean, you already had a problem with overcrowding, and that's one of the things that we know is that the social distancing is going to make a difference.
Absolutely. With every student in school, it is absolutely not possible to social distance. And so the state has issued some guidelines, and in their guidelines, they're recommending that students be wearing masks. Now, Summit County has issued an executive order that states that in all public buildings, everybody will be in masks. So as of right now, if we're not able to social distance to be true to the county order, all students, all faculty and staff would need to be wearing face masks throughout the day while in the building. Yeah. There is talk that the order might be adjusted to accommodate schools. But again, for us to be able to adhere to both the state guidelines and the county guidelines, as it stands today, everybody would need to be in masks.
Yeah, we have 10 times as many cases as we did in March when we closed the schools. Should we really be reopening them?
I think we've learned a lot more about the virus. And as you recall, when the virus first came out, there was a situation in a neighboring county, and they quarantined all high school students in that county. And today they know enough about the virus and managing it and controlling it that that same situation probably wouldn't happen. They would probably deal with it differently. And I think that's the reason that we're able to be considering opening schools, is just because of our knowledge of the virus and how to manage and who should be quarantined and for how long, and whether it should be a quarantine or a monitoring checking system. And I think our systems and our knowledge have increased enough that that allows us to be able to move forward.
Yeah, so as we welcome the students back, how is it that we're going to ensure that they are on grade?
That is going to be very difficult. I shouldn't say it's going to be difficult to assess. The challenge is going to be able to take students where they are and get them to the point where they need to be. And so there will be reading assessments, there will be math assessments, but faculty are prepared and ready to be able to adjust and know that the first part of the year may be bringing people up to where they needed to be to start the course. And so there will be some acceleration that will need to happen. We also are very fortunate in our district that our Board of Education approved for us to have cameras in every classroom. And so because of that, we're now going to be able to take what's happening in the classroom, and even if a student isn't there, they will be able to view it shortly after that class has ended, and we've been able to put the recorded material online. Or in some situations, we're hoping that there can be live interactive sessions happening where students at home can be viewing and participating with the class while it's in session.
Yeah.
We haven't been able to test the bandwidth as much, but so we're hoping those types of strategies will help us to close that gap. And it will be interesting, because we know that school at home was different for people, and some may not have a learning gap at all because they were able to do the online school at home, and others may have a more significant learning gap. And so there's going to be a need for personalized instruction more so than ever before.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about how the Silver Summit Academy helped prepare the school district for this kind of new blended learning model.
You know, we are very fortunate because we've been doing blended learning over there since the beginning, so we're in our third year. And so there are lessons to be learned. Probably the thing that is most helpful is that the faculty have tried this and tried that, and some worked and some didn't. And so they are able to share with their colleagues best practices that they've found and things to avoid, pitfalls to avoid. And so I think that's probably been one of the most helpful things.
All right. Well, let's talk about your teachers. Are they okay with coming back? Because what we're hearing is that children could be asymptomatic, but certainly vectors for the disease.
You know, our teachers' opinions vary as much as parents' opinions. And that's where it gets difficult. You have some teachers that are ready to just bring everybody back and do things as normal as possible. And then you have other teachers that, you know, have conditions themselves or have family members that put them in a high-risk category that do have some reservations and some hesitancy. And so we are doing everything that we can to protect our faculty. Their health and safety is equal to the health and safety of our students. Everybody needs to be taken into consideration. And so, again, doing things in this plan to accommodate as much social distancing as possible, starting out slow with an AB schedule can help mitigate some of the risk that is involved, providing the correct personal protective equipment is of high importance, and so we're making sure that we have plenty of that available for our faculty and staff, and that they know what they need to provide to keep themselves safe as well. And then making sure that they that we're looking for all possibilities for those that are in the highest risk categories for how they may be able to still contribute to the district and perform their job.
So will you be short of teachers?
Right now we aren't, and we are hoping that's not the case. But again, when it comes right down to it and the final decision is there, teachers will have to make that decision as to whether, because there's no way that we can have a teacher working from home and have 30 students in a classroom as much as we would like to. We have the technology to make that happen, but the classroom behavior and monitoring is an important responsibility of the faculty.
Yeah, I would think so. So, again, through tell me a little bit about the process then. I mean, the Board of Education approves a plan that gets submitted to the County Health Department, which then has to approve it before it goes on to the state. Is that how it works?
Actually, the Board of Education's plan goes directly to the state. The County Health Department is a partner in developing the plan and integral. And our plan is released, you will see the County Health Department interwoven in so many of the decision-making and the training and the information sources that need to be adhered to.
And what about school buses?
School buses will run if they are at capacity. Social distancing is not possible. Masks will absolutely have to be worn. And then as students arrive to school, there will be a health check, symptom check, monitoring system in place. Much of that, we're hoping that we can rely on parents, and there will be a lot of information and education sent to parents asking them to please do self-monitoring at home, please do temperature checks, and do not send if there are any symptoms at all. We've taken a look at our absenteeism and both our rewards and our procedures, and there will not be penalties for students staying home to preserve their own health and the health of our faculty and staff and students.
Okay, and then what about the playgrounds and cafeterias? How are we going to manage those?
Those are a little bit more easily managed. We've found a way where we can bring in a class at a time, starting and extending the breakfast and lunch hours, managing recess so that smaller groups of students are out there at any given time, hand washing before lunch, and before recesses, and hand washing after, and sanitization available for hands, and then daily sanitization of the playgrounds as long as the weather is permissible. And by that I'm saying if the sanitization that you put on the playgrounds starts to freeze, that creates a more greater hazard to students than the sanitization protects from the virus.
Okay. Finally, just wanted to ask you about the master planning process. Where do things stand there?
As of our last board meeting, the Board of Education has decided not to bond this coming year. They did approve expenditures, and there will be portables at the high school this year. And we've been able to do some things in our buildings that will help to mitigate growth for another year. We're looking at possibly doing some things over at Silver Summit to help with growth there, exploring different options of renting space or looking for a temporary portable for that school. And then if we go to the AB schedule, that helps a whole bunch with growth. And so that you have to take that into account, doing things to reduce the number of students that are in the building because of the virus not only helps with mitigating the virus spread, but it also helps with our growth. But okay. I am happy to report that our Board of Education is planning to do truth in taxation. And because of that truth in taxation, that gave the flexibility for Adam to be able to have the funds in our budget to do negotiations with our faculty and with our staff to be able to continue to take care of their needs.
All right, so what are we talking about? We didn't hear that in terms of a tax increase.
actually the taxpayer isn't going to see anything different. Because of the growth, the taxpayer is going to be paying the same amount of money as they paid this year. They would have seen a slight decrease, but by being able to keep our tax levy where it will be, then they're not going to see a tax increase. They're going to be paying the same amount of money, but because of the growth, there will be more money into the budget to be able to do some things that we need to do to keep moving forward and progressing as a district.
Okay. Hey, Rob or Adam, anything else you'd like to add?
Just one of the things that we're doing this summer to help negate some of the loss of teaching time last year is we got a grant from the federal government to pay for some summer school. And so all of our schools are actually doing some summer school to help some of those kids that need additional help this summer. And that's one of the things that we're proud of this summer is getting that done. So, and we're thankful for all of our tax, our citizens for helping us to be successful with these kids.
Okay. Shad, Adam, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Well, while COVID-19 was the major topic for the Summit County Council last week, they also looked at such items as financial aid for the county, tax rates, and the county's profile on television. During their July 1st meeting, the council heard a presentation on the Rural County Grant Program. It was authorized in the 2020 Utah Legislature. Councilmember Kim Carson said there have been several different programs set up in the past to help diversify the economy in those rural areas.
It was kind of a hodgepodge, and what they did, because things were so scattered and people really weren't sure, both businesses and counties, of just what was available and who was able to apply for different pots. They simplified it in that they just created one larger program, but it's more flexible in its use. We'll be looking at creating a county economic development advisory board. That'll be our first step. And, I do hope that this can be used to help improve access to funding for some of our minority populations and just really diversifying the economy as a whole. We've seen the impact this year like we've never seen before of kind of having all our eggs in one basket.
On another item, the county auditor presented the certified tax rates for 2020 for the county and other local taxing entities. In that presentation, he noted that property valuations went up in several areas. We asked Carson if those values will take a dive due to the pandemic.
We haven't so far seen a big indication that there's a large decline. We just don't think we'll probably see as large of an increase this year. But again, we'll have to wait and see.
And any indication what this means for our property tax bills?
Well, the rate actually floated down because as the total assessed valuation goes up, we're not permitted to capture anything but the amount for brand new growth.
She added that you likely won't see an increase in your taxes unless your property was subject to one of the county's periodic reassessments. And in an informal discussion, the council talked about the county seat. This is a program that's shown on weekend television in cooperation with the Utah Association of Counties. Carson said the program has been useful to showcase what's going on in Summit County or to focus on important issues like wildfire prevention. The county has made payments going back about 2 years for segments on the show, but Carson said the expense may be a want rather than a need.
They have occasionally, approached us, particularly when we're down at the legislature during the session, and asked us to participate, would you like to be part of this panel discussion? And so this past year that happened, and we really weren't aware that they were adding another segment to our costs. We haven't agreed to pay for those. However, we feel like the ones that we have done have been useful, but we'll evaluate it again going forward. Again, this year with our current budget concerns, we're not going to be too likely to spend any additional money on things that are nice to have.
Finally, Carson said she was happy with the Democratic primary vote last week, selecting her successor on the county council. She said there were two good candidates to choose from, but she had endorsed last week's winner, Melina Stevens, over Candace Hart. The November general election is still ahead, but there are no other declared candidates. She said Stevens will be a fine addition to the council.
I think she has a skill set that will complement the other skill sets that we currently have on the council and just bring a different perspective.
That's Summit County Council Member Kim Carson. And there is a new tally in the Democratic race for Summit County Council. Melina Stevens widened her lead over Candace Hart to 1,437 votes in the race for County Council. Stevens led Hart in the Democratic primary by just under 1,000 votes after the first batch of results was released last Tuesday night. After Thursday's vote count, Stevens has 2,601 votes compared to Hart's 1,164. No Republican candidate is currently challenging for the seat. Unless there is a write-in candidate in November, the winner of the race between Stevens and Hart will become the next Summit County Councilor. KPCW News time now, 8:57. The county's mask order went into effect on midnight of June 26. Before the council voted July 1st to modify portions of the order, they heard from Todd Fulmer, a 14-year resident of Park City, who said that the county has taken the wrong approach.
I don't believe your focus is backed by science. I believe your focus should be on people that have comorbidities that are at risk, and you are subjecting the entire population, irrespective of the infection fatality rate, which is minuscule, for children, for people under the age of 70.
Fulmer said he doesn't object to wearing a mask, but in some businesses, such as yoga studios or fitness facilities, you can't wear a mask during strenuous exercise. He said access to those operations is important for residents to maintain their mental health at a time like this. He told council members they need to think outside the box.
The track that you're on is going to mean there's going to be no winter tourist season in Park City. There's nothing that you're doing now, and your micromanagement, you know, the original order with like pencils on golf carts, your thoughts about micromanaging are not helpful. I don't believe they're moving the dial at all.
And he said education has to reopen.
I think the kids should be back in school now. I think that the teaching community, people that are vulnerable to the disease, should not be in the classroom. But that doesn't mean kids should not be in school. So I just think that your focus is very badly misplaced, that it is going to destroy this community. It's destroying the mental health of this community right now. You're scaring people that don't need to be scared, that aren't going to die if they get this disease.
In response, Council Chairman Doug Clyde said that the scientific data clearly backs up what the county has done, and he said that sectors of the local tourist economy support the county's efforts to show that Park City area will be relatively safe this winter. Health Director Rich Bulla said they needed to take a community-wide approach, and he said children can still be carriers of the virus who can spread it to other family members.
I'm incredibly uncomfortable with the notion that we're willing to sacrifice older adults and individuals with comorbid conditions because others of us don't want to take the responsibility of caring for each other and assuring that we don't transmit the disease to others. That entire concept is foreign to me, to be honest with you.
That's Summit County Health Director Rich Bulla. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. Stay tuned now for headline news and Mountain Money.